Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And dare I say, we have an exciting show this evening. First of all, we're going to be starting out with the two executive producers of the Project Blue Book. It's coming out season two in just, I think it's January 21st, and coming right up. I am so fortunate that I do this show and I get to watch screeners. So I've watched through the first three screeners, and I'm really liking it, really liking the show. And so we get to talk to both Sean Jablonski and David O'Leary, the executive producers. They have excellent backgrounds. All that information's in our show notes, so you can see their full biographies and all that. So I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. Your support is greatly appreciated. And I also want to thank the people that help out in the background. There's so many that really do help behind the scenes. The information I get from listeners is always quite interesting. A lot of people have been writing me about the drones out in Colorado. I don't know if anyone has been following that. But anyway, I think in a second segment with Ted Rowe from Hawaii, he's going to be talking about that. He is the executive director of NARCAP, and he'll be talking about aviation and that as well, as far as the so-called drones. No one is really committing to what they are, and that's what makes them interesting in my point, in my view anyway. So right now I'm going to be bringing on Sean Jablonski and David O'Leary. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Marty. Thanks
pleasure,
so much.
Pleasure to be here.
Yes. David, you were on last year when this show first came out, and it was a lot of fun.
Had we started airing yet, or was it like the build-up to airing? I can't recall.
I think it was just ahead of time, just like this.
Right.
And
it's hard to believe that was only a year ago. Yeah, it's
a lot has happened, hasn't it?
A lot has happened in a year. Yeah.
And I just mentioned a few minutes ago, I was lucky enough to be able to watch the screeners. I got to the third one last night and I fell asleep, but had nothing to do with your show.
Right.
a couple things I want to say.
We get it. We're both dads. We understand. I got an infant. I fall asleep during like my favorite shows. So I get it. I totally understand.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed this year, now I don't know if it's changed since last year, but is there like a different use of filters or something? The lighting is really very vintage looking. It looks really like right in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, I because we also come into a very different environment for the show. We start in, you know, Roswell is our first two episodes, and then
that's
Area 51. Yeah. We're in the desert, which is something we never had a chance to do shooting first season in sort of rainy winter Vancouver.
That's right.
Even when we played other states in Vancouver, we never got to the desert. So our DP, who was fabulous, Kim Miles, feature DP as well as a veteran of television, brings such a vision and a cinematic look to everything. He had a sense that we really wanted to accentuate those sort of sepia tones and make you feel like you were in the desert.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And we were fortunate for a week. We actually did go out to the desert and shot in what's called Kamloops, which is 4 hours north of Vancouver, really out in the desert. And it's got the look and feel of like New Mexico and Nevada and Arizona. And it's gorgeous up there. And we got really fortunate that our shooting schedule aligned with sort of our storytelling, that it could be the hot summer instead of the cold winter Vancouver, and provide a whole new look for the show.
Wow. David, I think I mentioned to you last year, I kind of get obsessed, and it's sort of like a sickness, because I'm in the fine arts and the antique, so I get really obsessed with screens, you know, with settings in movies, whether they're correct or not historically. And
sure.
First of all, I want to say I love the paintings that the Hynek's have.
So do we.
The X-Wing fighter paintings?
Yeah.
And the Danish modern furniture. And so far, nothing has, you know, I mean, I'm miserable to be with when it comes to like old movies and stuff, because I'll say, hey, that rocker there was made in 1860 and this is supposed to be 1851,
sure,
you know, or something like that. So,
right.
But anyway, whoever is doing that type of thing is doing an excellent job, in my opinion.
We have an amazing props person who, like, he literally is the guy who knows everything. This guy named Jay Drover. And then our set deck, Janessa, she's wonderful. I mean, Ross, our
Ross
set,
Dempster, yeah. Who's our sort of captain, our production yep. designer, is meticulous and constantly world building for us, not just for the 50s, but when we go to places like the desert or Area 51 yep. or, you know, whatever new state we're in or new world we're going to inhabit, he comes with everything.
And I know that a red flag goes up for those guys if we're featuring something that is not true to the time period that we're in. Occasionally we're like, listen, you know, it's 6 months, it's a year, it's a couple of years, we need it for our storytelling, like, we're gonna get dinged on this, but it's okay. But yeah. when we can avoid that, we want to avoid that because we really want to live in that era as you know, as truthfully as we can.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure you just talked about getting dinked, and I'm sure the UFO community, you know, has been giving, you know, mixed reviews about this show, which I think, and I have mentioned on a couple of different you know, Facebook postings or something. This is based on, you know, what Alan Hynek went through. It's based on it, but it's fiction. I mean, there's That's a right. lot of fiction to it. But I know that the purists out there, the UFO purists, are hammering when anything, and not just this show, you know, Unidentified and you know, any other show that comes along, kind of gets hammered when it comes to these UFO purists, so to speak. But I take yeah. it as entertainment. And I love the way, you know, the first two episodes in the Roswell, you kind of wove in some of these reality facts with yeah. some things that might have happened later, and y'all kind of spun around. And you know, I got it. And I really liked it. I was very entertained. I really liked it a lot.
Thank yeah. you. And I just want to say I love the purists, and I appreciate that they're even paying that degree of attention. Yes. And if we were a documentary, we should be raked over the coals, you know. We say that, you know, look, we're still trying to make good TV, too. But I want to speak to them for a second and say, look, we have nothing but absolute respect and take a lot of care when we do approach the cases. They are our jumping off point, though, because we still have to tell a great TV show.
That's right.
Or entertain an audience that isn't also the, you know, the deep divers in that way. You know, we say it's based on a case. History does do us the benefit of giving the little wrap up at the end that right. sort of gives you facts on the case. Mm-hmm. And look, even some of these great movies that are out there that, you know, I think of, like, even the Mr. You know, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood,
sure, exactly.
you know, the Mr. Rogers
yeah,
movie out
example.
Now with Tom Hanks. We know not all of that happened, but I think you surrender it because you want to see a good story. I will say this, too. I was very inspired when I watched Inglourious Basterds for the first time. Mm. Now, that's an extreme example.
Right.
But I remember thinking at the end when Hitler was murdered in a theater, I was both shocked and also, like, elated mm-hmm. by it, in that it was so courageous to go, I'm going to take history as a spine and then make this strong creative choice to entertain people and give them something great. We do have the benefit too of having Paul Hynek, who is yep. Alan Hynek's son, as our technical advisor, and he has been tremendous in supporting us as well. And a lot of times he says, you know what, my dad would have loved that.
That's right.
My dad has a sense of humor, he would have loved that.
That's so right.
It feels like it gives us
one of my favorite Paul yeah. Hynek quotes yeah. was, like, you know what Dr. J. Allen Hynek would have done with Project Blue Book? He would have sat down on his couch, made his popcorn, and enjoyed it with the rest of us. And listen, you know, we're here to entertain. That's exactly what it is. We do root our episodes in real life cases. That segment at the end is all about encouraging people to learn more about the real life case that inspired this week's episode. You know, and sometimes with our storytelling, you know, we have to make choices. Like with Roswell, obviously, you know, we're not going to, like, pretend that, you know, our show universe takes place in 1953. We're not going to pretend that Roswell happened in 1953. We know it's, you know, we treat it, it's 6 years after the fact, but how can we explore such a great case? Well, what we do is we look at, well, what really happened there? There was a massive cover-up, right? A town was shut down and silenced. What would happen if, you know, if something happened there, if things started to bubble to the surface again because of what occurred there? And that leads our guys into a whole journey. And And then every clue and every kind of, you know, turn that they come across is something that is inspired by things that we read and in the real life case files and all of that. So
and we do our diligence. Like, yeah. I said, it's I really want to stress that we don't take it lightly.
No.
These are people's lives we're dealing with. This is a history. And so we want to make sure we do the work first so we understand it so that we know what we're doing.
Right.
And we have, the utmost respect for the facts and for the people involved.
Yeah.
As I do hope that they understand we're trying to be entertaining as well. And it's a delicate balance.
Now, I got the pleasure of spending quite a bit of time with Paul Hynek in Phoenix this last September, and awesome. Oh my God, the guy is so funny.
He's amazing.
Oh, he's incredible.
He's got such a sense of humor. I remember he when he did his talk, he showed a picture of a belt that was wrapped up in a box, and he said, "That's my Van Allen belt." He said, "Van Allen actually gave this belt to my dad."
That's right.
And that's just a typical thing of something he would say. But he did, I talked to him about, you know, again, this question that I just asked you, you know, how the purists, are they attacking you? Are they, you know, leaving you alone or whatever? And he said that in season two, there was only one thing that he objected to, and he said it was respected. And I believe it was something that he knew his father would never say. Had something to do with science. You probably know what I'm talking about. But
yep, we do. Yep. Well, all the time. I mean, that's what where Paul and Joel are so valuable is just like, you know, they'll catch things. They know their father better than anybody, and I think have been so instrumental for us to try to paint a portrait on a character perspective to be as, you know, as truthful as we can be and try to honor who he was and honor his legacy. And, you know, and they are wonderful at catching things that we miss and giving us details that help us, you know, that help us build story, that help us build great character moments, that help us three-dimensionalize the character that Aidan Gillen plays so that it feels more, you know, truer and even closer to Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And, you know, he's lived such a fabulous, you know, an incredible life. And we, you know, we're just honored that we get to be a part of that legacy by, you know, showing it on the TV screen, you know?
When you have a something that you're planning on writing, you know, like, say, a Blue Book case, how much pressure is there to make it, you know, other than what happened? In other words, you know, is there a lot of pressure? I mean, are there cases out there that are, you know, fantastic enough to support the story and then you just have to embellish? Or does there always have to be, like, you know, a part fiction in a story?
Some of them are, you know, especially this season, we chose some pretty seminal cases. Roswell, Area 51, Maury Island is coming up.
Yep.
Quite soon. Roswell really didn't need a lot. There's a lot of facts that we laid in there that were part of the actual case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, something like Area 51, like, there's nothing, I mean, you can find everything that has to speculate about what goes on there.
Yeah.
There's very little available in that sense. And even to the degree a lot of cases are, I mean, we were talking about this earlier because we're already working on season three right now.
Yep.
Really?
Which is not, you know, well, it's not anything official.
Yeah.
But we just like to keep the pump primed.
Just in case.
You mean you're not approved for season three, but you're
we want to be ready. You know, we want to be ready. We try to come back. We came back 1 year basically after season two. So,
yeah.
But sorry. Yeah.
No. You know, if you think about it, a lot of times Blue Book got called to a scene of a crime where there was no evidence, a lot of times, body, you know, if you're talking a crime, anything. Somebody goes, "I saw lights here," and there's nothing there. And you've got to rely a lot of times on witness testimony, and you sort of have to build out from that. So
that's right.
I have done a few historical pieces in the past, and I think what you have to do is you have to really study the history, know your characters, sort of read between the lines and try to connect those dots.
Yep.
And that's about sort of walking a mile in their shoes and trying to understand what their motivations might be. I think a good spine for us as well is the overarching conspiracy that we know is a fact about how the government was actively working to cover up the existence of flying saucers and get disinformation out there.
That's right. And sometimes what we'll do is we'll borrow from a case like Area 51's a great one. Like we didn't, you know, Area 51's a black box. We don't know what really goes on there. Everybody can speculate, right? We all have our ideas of what goes on there. But we do, we found a great case. I don't want to spoil it or say anything much about it, but that also took place on an Air Force base that we kind of marry with the Area 51 case, right? I go back and I think about the Lubbock's Lights case, which obviously is a famous, famous case. There are some elements of that case that we borrowed potentially, some would argue, from like the Levelland Lights case, which was another Texas, famous Texas UFO case, and kind of merged the two. And there's occasionally moments where we're like, hey, like there was a similar case here that had these ingredients. There's this case here that we really want to feature, you know, but we try to stay true to like the ingredients are rooted in cases that occurred. The historical events are all things you can look up and point to. So that's like if you were to like take apart our storytelling, you would be like, oh no, that happened. There really were bomb shelters that people built in the 50s, and there really was a, you know, like, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So those deep sort of like ingredients that inspire story always come from the history books, always come from articles, always come from cases. And then, to some degree, we throw them in a blender and we make them work for us for the story that we're trying
to
tell.
Betty and Barney Hill is a good example from last year. Obviously, we changed the names, but they didn't hold anybody hostage to insist that somebody, believe their story. But the idea of drawing Pleiades on a, you know, with circles on a map, you know, going under hypnosis and reliving the abduction, driving home, that all the stuff.
The missing time
and whining, you know, all of that stuff was based on that. And he suffered for his whole life from that.
Yeah. Yep.
And so when you go, that's your jumping off point from a story, and here's somebody who needs to be believed. Well, then it makes sense that you bring them into Blue Book and go, you have to believe me. And that case took place in the 60s,
right?
Where in 53, had to make it up, but again, inspired by
two events. And keep in mind, we don't know whether we're going to get the opportunity to tell more stories, right? Even now, right? We're still like, and it's like, oh gosh, like it's such a great seminal case. We got, and you know, we're looking for an abduction case. This case is one of the best ones. We gotta grab it and seize it while we know we can. They give us 10 episodes and we do it. And then, you know what I mean? And they're like, well, you should have saved, you know, waited till season 4 or 5 to do that. When you're in the 60s, it's like, we don't know if we're going to get that far.
We want to
give people the best ride they can go on with some of the best cases and the most interesting facts and, you know, and take them on a ride and then hopefully provoke discovery and of their own. Then they can, you know, I think as Sean said, that video piece at the end of our episodes, I think, is really great because it really draws a clear line in the sand of being like, hey, that was fun. That was great. Hopefully you feel that way. Here's more about the real life case. And now, like, go explore, do the deep dive. You know, there's so much out there.
Yeah, that's very important, I think. You know, when I first saw Roswell, I went, oh, no, another Roswell story. But it was excellent. It was really, really good. It's a part one and part two for the person out there. Now I would like to ask you, Sean, because Dave kind of gave his background last year, but as far as your background in this subject, have you had an interest? I mean, you seem well versed so far in the topic. Have you had an interest in the topic?
Yeah, so look, I claim to have had a sighting when I was about 10 or 11 years old, living in New York City, saw these hexagonal lights, had a very sort of moment in time where I remember looking up at them, going through my mind going, it's not a blimp, it's not a plane, it's very slow moving, what am I seeing? I asked someone on the street, do you see that? We looked up at it, it was very clear, it always stuck with me. Led to a lifelong interest in it to the point where it was about 10 years ago. I literally went on a solo trip down to Machu Picchu because I was like, I told my then wife, I was like, I got to see if aliens built this thing. That's the degree to which I haven't had an interest, to the point where when David and I first met, because, you know, David created the series, wrote the pilot. I came on to help out. And when we had to have our first meeting and discussion, we met in this diner.
Yeah.
And we were just trading stories.
Yeah.
And I got a parking ticket because my meter expired after 2 hours. We just forgot how long we'd been there. So.
And you can't fake that.
It's called missing time.
Missing time.
Yeah, missing time. Yeah, yeah. You know, Sean's passion for the subject matter, Sean's knowledge of the subject matter. I mean, and I'd love for him to share a little background about his. I mean, he's got an amazing background in television as well. But sure. You know what I mean? He's the perfect partner because he brings all this experience to TV that I frankly didn't have, but also shares my deep passion for the subject matter, knew everything I was talking about, brought his own stuff in, brought his own points of view in, cases, things I'd never heard of before. And it's like a mind meld, you know what I mean? And that's how great television hopefully happens, is like, and then it builds out from there, and other people get involved and bring their creativity. So it's like,
I was just going to ask you that. Do you have a team? I'm sorry.
No. I mean, like, and that's one of the great things I think about the partnership that we have, is that it's completely, we are both obsessed with this stuff. We both know it really well. That's why we have such deep respect for the UFO purists, because I think, listen, prior to creating a show like this, I was somebody who was just an amateur UFO historian, you know, just somebody going down the road and working on scripts and a UFO guy on the side and whatever. And I just got fortunate. We both got fortunate that our two interests to tell stories and our obsession with UFOs aligned.
Yeah. Great. So, Sean, just your background real quickly, your television background. I saw it's pretty quite impressive.
Yeah, it's funny. It's over 20 years at this point. My sort of mentor teacher in the business, Tom Fontana, who, you know, Emmys for St. Elsewhere, Homicide on the Street, cut my teeth as a staff writer on Oz HBO, you know, created a show for Showtime shortly after, worked on Law & Order. Suits, basically helped run the first season there. I did 7 years on Nip Tuck as an EP, directed episodes as well. Had my own show on USA, Satisfaction.
Yeah.
I worked on a Michael Mann show. I've been in the, I'm what you call a veteran at this point. So I've had the fortune to work with a lot of wonderful teachers. Like I said, you know, Ryan Murphy, Tom Fontana, Michael Mann, Dick Wolf, I've been doing it for a minute, as the cool kids say.
Yeah. And how, as far as Project Blue Book in the series, how do you pick out, a story you want to talk about to begin with? How does that all?
Yeah.
We only have about a minute. We're going to go into break. But just if you can wrap something up fairly quickly.
The very quick answer to that is the Blue Book cases are the Bible, but then so is the history of all the major cases in UFO land. So we start there with a great case, and then we ask, how do our characters fit into this? And if it feels like it's a great marriage, we run with it.
That's right. We try to find a metaphor for the case that's happening, with something happening with our characters on the ground, that's up in the sky and on the ground. And we do our own research and we combine it, and hopefully, and so many times we come up with the same stuff. We're like, yes, we got to do this case. So,
yeah. And your actors are great. All the actors are really, really good. I'm trying to remember his name that plays Littlefinger, whatever he was called, who plays Jay Allen.
Yeah, Lord Baelish. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he is really, really good. And we have in the chat, we have the agent for the Russian lady. He's in the chat room.
Yeah.
Dave Altman.
Ksenia Solo's agent is in the chat right now.
That's right.
Oh. That's fantastic.
Well, she should tell you that we are Ksenia's biggest fan.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't. One thing I don't understand.
There's no one that could do that role but Ksenia. Nobody.
What I don't understand, I know
we searched until we found her, and that was that's how that happened.
I know she's really Russian, and my girlfriend is Russian, and
and also a spy unknowingly behind your back.
Oh yes, I'm sure. But anyway. I don't understand how she can do an American accent so well. I mean,
it's sort of one of those, like, she's more, when you speak to her, she has the American accent, but has a Russian background. So I would say it's more American first and then Russian. But
yeah, she's purely bilingual. Yeah, I mean, I think she's probably, I think she's half and half.
Yeah.
She can speak English. You would never, ever know. I mean, she speaks English like you and I.
Yeah, perfectly. Yeah. Okay, so we're heading into the break now. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages. You think we're on a break, but we're not really. We're actually still live on YouTube. So we're on a break from the radio station, but we're actually live on YouTube. So this is where we will get into a different topic you know, just during this 3.5 minutes or so. But where are you right now? What town are you in? I mean, you don't have to say the town if you don't feel
it. So right now we are sitting in
Roswell.
Yeah, we're in Roswell, New Mexico, live at the site. We're at the Mac Brazel Ranch.
I see the palm trees.
He's doing all
right. Of course.
He's doing okay these days, you know? We're sitting at Sean Jablonski's home. I won't disclose the address, but I will say it's in Sherman Oaks, Los Angeles, near our production office.
Yeah, I have a friend out there in Sherman Oaks. Yeah, beautiful. Now, was that area? Did you get smoke from the fires there a little while ago?
Not this year so much, but last year it felt like Armageddon. Some of the smoke clouds were just. Wow, I can't imagine. And I think about the people in Australia and what they must be going through.
But just terrible.
When there are fires, the smoke, you really can't underestimate that because it affects you inside, outside. You can't get away from it. It's what you breathe. It's really – it's oppressive. I it's really scary stuff.
Yep. Those fires were for real. I mean, my manager's house almost burnt down. And, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff.
Now, what about
the concrete jungle part of LA? So I don't. The fires are. Yeah.
Now, where does Project Blue Book get filmed?
Vancouver, in Vancouver, Canada, and we're pretty much in and around the city proper.
That's right.
I think the farthest we've ever filmed outside was Kamloops, which is about 4.5 hours, and that stood in for the deserts of New Mexico
and New Mexico and Nevada.
But mostly in and around there.
And how long does the average episode, how much filming, you know, how much tape do you have edited down to the, you know, whatever it is?
Well, each episode, 8 days, you know, we film an episode every 8 days, 8 production days. Mm-hmm. And then the process begins of like, you know, and there's different cuts, you know what I mean? There's the assembly that the editor puts together. Then the director comes in and does the director's cut. Then, you know, we look at it. Sean looks at it. We look at it. There's that sort of the producer's pass. Then we take it into the studio. The studio takes a look at it. We get feedback from them, network. And that can take multiple rounds too. It's a little bit like a script. I mean, it's sort of a fun little insider thing in TV. But like the final episode, as it's cut, is very much like a screenplay where you get notes and hey, in that moment, like, do we have any? Can we flip around and be on Quinn on that angle, or do we have that? Sometimes we have it, sometimes we don't. You know, but everyone brings their sort of perspective to it, which is kind of cool. And it ends up. And then we move on to sound and VFX and all these other things. So it's like multiple rounds. I mean, I always marvel at how many layers of data are going on at any given time on the show. You know what I mean? Like sound design, VFX, like editing, 10 different layers of.
We finished shooting episode 10 in October, November.
Yeah,
we wrapped
November 6th,
and we're mixing that in March.
Yeah, we will be on the air and sound mixing, meaning sort of making sure that the levels of sound design and music and dialogue all kind of, you know, work in concert. When we're on the air a couple weeks before the thing airs, you know, so it's
we need every hour of 3 months to get that final episode ready.
All right. Welcome back. My guests are Sean Jablonski and David O'Leary, executive producers of Project Blue Book, coming out January 21st. Is it 10/9 Central, or I mean, how does that?
It is
10 o'clock. Yeah, on the History Channel.
Yeah, 10/9 Central on for those with Central, 10 o'clock, otherwise East Coast, West Coast. Yeah.
But History Channel.
Let's History, on History.
Oh, yes, got to say the History Channel.
Only on History. Yeah, as
yes,
they say.
Only.
I got my 3-year-old daughter saying that, 10 p.m., only on History.
In all caps on the History.
That's right.
David, how much has your – I remember you were telling me when you found out that they were going to, you know, do this in the initial – you know, the moment you got the phone call, I think you said you were in New York, or maybe
I was at a restaurant with my family, and then the first thing they said was, we're going to order this straight to series 10 episodes. We're going to announce it tomorrow. Do not tell your family. And if you can believe it, I didn't. I actually, the only person I told was my wife. And we're at this huge dinner, and I text her under the table. She's like, "What's going on?" And I was like, "Straight to series 10 episodes." And she does, sorry, like that. She banged the table like 3 times with excitement. And then we went back to the meal. And it was like, but it was kind of cool that we got to kind of have it as a secret for like 12 hours, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. Has your life changed quite a bit since this? And in what ways?
I mean, listen, it, like, yes, of course, in some ways. And then in some ways, like, I'm sort of hoping, like, the answer is no, you know? I mean, like, yes, it has. I mean, like, it then became – I had never worked in professional television prior to the show. In terms of, like, anything in production, this is my first real produced credit. So, I mean, even being on a set, I remember driving – to set like the first day and being like, there are production assistants who have had much more experience on a professional set than I have. And here I come coming into a show that, you know, that here I am like a high level producer on and that I created. So, it has been a massive, massive crash course learning experience of the best kind and continues to be, you know what I mean? I think anybody sort of thrust into my position, and I'm fortunate enough to know a couple of people who have been in my shoes, where it's like never had, like, you know, sold a pilot straight to series order, you know, like, I have a couple of friends who've been in my shoes, and one of the first pieces of advice they said is like, is make sure you have a great showrunner, because that is what it's going to be about. And I took that advice to heart, and here he is, and voila! And then that guy was unavailable, and I ended up with this guy. Yeah. But there's been all kinds of ways that it's changed, I think, for the better, and that, like one of the most powerful things for me, honestly, is, like, and this is going to sound so stupid, maybe, but, like, I live tweet the show, like, on the East Coast feed, and I'm going to continue to do that this season. And for me, it's just an opportunity to kind of, I try to fathom how like 3 million people watch the show every week or whatever our numbers are. And that's something you can't grasp. But when you're sort of like interacting on social media with people you don't really know and they're responding positively, it's very powerful, and it actually makes it all worth it in the end. You know what I mean? Sure. Like, the fans are, we have the best fans, and like they do fan art. I collect the fans who follow me on social media know this. I collect everything. Like, I'm a bit of a hoarder. I collect like everything. If there's fan art that slips through the gaps, I apologize, because I really try to make an effort not to miss anything. And I like reposted and it's really genuinely because I'm just so like, A, some of the art is just so incredible, but B, it's just like, I'm just so happy that the show touches people and people get excited about it. And this is my first time ever working on something that has excited, obviously, that many people, or really excited anybody beyond like the executives and like my wife, you know? So it's like, it's immensely gratifying, that the show has worked, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But then in other ways, I still live in the same apartment I live in. I have another daughter. You know, I things change and they don't change. And I don't feel, it's weird. Like, I feel a little different, but I don't feel, I think when I was struggling, you know, to just try to come up, I think you think success looks like, well, it's going to make you feel a different way, or it's going to like change you, or maybe you hope it doesn't. And I'm sort of happy that I don't feel like I have the same insecurities then that I do now.
Thank God.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. Like, and I sort of sometimes honestly forget that, like, you know what I mean? I still, like, I hustled for so long out here. Like, I mean, I've been working in LA since I was 23 years old. I'm almost 40 years old. So I still have that kind of hustler's mentality of like, you know, like, we gotta, you know, you just gotta do the work, you know? And I think that's a good thing. I don't ever want to lose sight of that, actually. Like, I think if you lose that and lose just trying to put forth your best work, and he's amazing at that, like, hardest working guy, you know, ever. And has had many, has checked, you know, many, has had many yeses. You know, this is like my first big yes. So,
yeah.
But I think that's the key, is like, don't let the yeses, don't get complacent with the yes. Like for me now, it's just like, okay, how, let's keep this going. Let's make the show better. Let's keep learning. Let's keep evolving. Let's keep all that mm-hmm. stuff.
Mm-hmm. So as far as how you mentioned time, as far as time goes, does this project take both of your time day, you know, every single day, like year round, or do you take a break from it for, you know, however long and get back to it? I mean, how does that work?
I think we have a season, like if you were on a sports team, and if your goal is every year to win a championship, you don't take a day or an hour or a minute off if you're committed. And I think we're all a bunch of committed individuals. Writing is a process that even the best people that do it, it just takes time. So to that end, it's a 24/7 thing. I think for any of the listeners who, if you know anything or nothing about television or any sort of creative endeavor in that way, it's all encompassing. I don't think there's days off during the time that we're making it happen. Writing is a full-time thing that is constantly a moving target. You're constantly making adjustments and getting notes. And really a script, as hard as the work that goes into that, is just the beginning.
Yeah.
Because then you have to deal with casting and locations and props and set dressing and studio notes and network notes and music and budget and locations. And it's a nonstop thing. And every single choice, every decision, you want to be the absolute best, because you're trying to capture, you know, a moment in time, so to speak, and you only get one shot at it. So
it's true.
You got to definitely have a mentality of giving it your all. And when you don't, I think you quickly find the people who aren't willing to do that. And you clearly see where work suffers. So,
right.
Wow.
And it's true. It's like, Sean makes me think of moments where I'm like writing Sean an email about, like, and I'll spend like half an hour on this email for like that, for something that will take like, it's like a 1 second thing or something like that. But I'm like, I think it might be this or whatever. But it's like, you got to be that way. You sort of got to be in the deep, deep, deep weeds and make sure you're doing the right. You just said it so right. It's like the right decision about what seems like you made the right choice about big things was actually like the amalgamation of like so many right small choices. You know, and then of course there are big choices too, where it's like, casting and things like that, where you just got to make a choice. But that's, I think, where he's that way too. It's like, you know, is it this one or that one? I don't know. You know, it's like, and they're like slightly different, you know, and it's like, you just got it, but you got to, you know, it's worth it to get it right, because then you know you did your best and you move on.
Now, are you, like, if you're out, say, out in the town or whatever you're doing, totally, you know, supposedly off the hook, do you all of a sudden come up with an idea, like something pop in your head, or like something you see on the street or whatever, you know, gives you an idea and like, whoa, I mean, does this kind of like own you all the time, or, you know, maybe can you break from it?
I've gotten to a point now where, you know, like I said, I've been doing it so long, I tend to set aside my time. I'm open to the inspiration at any point, but I kind of have a very regimented schedule. I'm usually up anywhere between 5 and 6, usually closer to 5, and use morning until lunch to make that the time of the creative writing process. You know, so a lot of times I have to work more to turn it off, than anything, and be there for friends, family.
Yeah, family.
It's that's the biggest struggle, because you I think anybody who works hard, and it's funny, I feel like when people like want to say, well, your job is not what you do, it's not who you are. And I go, name me another thing most people do 8 to 10 hours a day, and you want to tell me it doesn't mean much.
Right.
You know what I mean? Of course it does. It defines who you are. It drives what you do. It provides security. It does provide identity. It's a very big part of who you are.
It is.
And look, I'd like to think we're all creative on some level in what we do. I think by nature, that's what people are. They like to be creative. And so to that end, it's always a part of us. And I think we have a unique job in that, in order to do that, you have to constantly be plugged into this sort of like universal, like, you know, creative unconsciousness that allows mm-hmm. that stuff to come in. We have to keep those channels
and
open.
And create, totally. I love the creative consciousness idea. And, like, and you know, and it's a muscle, too, I think, like anything else. Like, you know, if you've been out of it for a while, I think it's like, you know, with writing or thinking creatively or storytelling, you know, you just the more you work that muscle, it's like going to the gym. It's like anything else. It's like it does get sharpened, and you are suddenly like you can feel it when you're in a different kind of creative space where things are just more kind of starting to hit. And I know you know what I'm talking about.
There's a place called the Brill Building where they used to have all the songwriters in New York.
Yeah,
I know Willie Nelson was a part of it, but yeah. That was their job. They would show up like 9 to 5 kind of thing and write songs.
Yeah,
you know, it's amazing. Like if you stick at it, you develop a muscle. You know
right.
what I mean?
It's
well,
true.
I hear about the Saturday Night Live writers, and you know how they wrote. You know, like Tuesday night, they were up all night. You know, every Tuesday night they had to, you know, they had to get the nuts and bolts done at that point.
That's right.
So
we have those moments too, you know, like where it's just like our backs are against the wall, like production needs something on Monday, and we're, you know, we try not to get in those situations, but those situations occur, you know.
Would it be? I'm just getting the call screener at the station. We're just getting that set up over there. But do you mind if we take a couple of calls? We have some people that want to call in.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That will be in just a minute as soon as he gets set up there. But now you said you're starting already on season 3. I think that's pretty exciting. If that does happen to happen, do you have kind of like a theme you're going to go into? You know, I know the first year there was a certain time period that you stuck to, the first season. Do you already have something like in mind or something you can share, or is that something you wouldn't want to discuss?
I would say that, you know, we approach every season as you would approach like telling a movie or telling a book. You're going to have an overall thematic approach that winds up being your guiding North Star in terms of telling story. And so, yes, that's how we approach things. I can tell you how we did season 2, which we're also very excited about, which is, you know, look, the first season was all about the mystery was in the sky, and it was about trying to understand what was going on up there. And now it's about going back to the beginning of the phenomenon and understanding where the mystery began on the ground with the conspiracy.
That's right.
And something like that became our guiding North Star for the season and drove us each case, each episode, each scene, how we wanted to tell it.
That's
so
right.
When we look ahead, and again, there's no we're doing this because we're sort of primed and we're still all together, and if there's opportunity, we'll be ready. But that is how we approach it. But it's nothing, you know, I wouldn't want to give anything away on a season 3 before get
season
people
2 even airs. Yeah, that's right.
Well,
but Sean hit it on the head. I mean, I think we're going to – what's great now is we get to both be – I think what's happening on the ground is as exciting as what's happening up in the sky.
Yeah.
And we do not – and we are still doing some of the best, most seminal cases. I think there's going to be some surprises on some of the cases that we pick. And then it's also about how that cover up, how that conspiracy, how all that works, how that operates, how that manifests. And then there's even a couple of new ingredients of other things going on that connect that we throw in there too. So it's I think we're both and hopefully everybody out there is excited about it. Because we really are. We feel really good and I think proud about where we are season 2. So
I'm really, really enjoying it. I'm hooked on watching this for sure. We have a caller.
But before
the caller comes in, I just want to mention something quickly about last week's show. I did a show with Vic Mignogna and Mark Cushman last year, and this was about Star Trek. And Vic was involved in Star Trek Continues, and I just want to say a follow-up on that show from last week. First of all, we got a ton of email, a lot of really positive feedback, but I want to encourage everyone to watch that series. It's free on the internet. Anyone can watch it. 11 episodes. I watched them all, and it was absolutely great. So that was just a follow-up on last week. I wanted to make sure I said that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So we have Dave Altman on the line. Dave, welcome to the show.
I know Dave.
Yeah.
I know Dave.
Dave, you there?
Really? I do.
Dave, you're on air.
Dave Altman.
There might be some type of technical problem. It shows that he's on air here.
Dave Altman is a wonderful guy. By the way, a huge UFO, just a knowledge base of UFOs. And he's also what's called an appearance agent. I think I mentioned him to you.
Yes, yes.
So Dave, you know, can although you Dave's doing down. Dave's doing a bunch of stuff. Oh, Dave.
Dave, are you there? Me?
Sir.
Can you hear me?
There you go. You're there. Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay, you can hear me now.
Yes.
Yes. What's up, man?
Awesome. All right. Happy New Year, man. Yeah, it's funny because I actually text Martin and I said, I'm an appearance agent. You're going to get me in trouble.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I say that. I saw that in the text now, but I can't read the text while I'm doing the show. So
I know.
I love getting people in trouble anyway, so it's yeah. Fine. Yeah.
I know. Yeah, I'm looking so forward to the upcoming season. I'm psyched.
Paul,
I got an invitation. I got an invitation to go watch it with Paul. Paul sent me an email to go, you know, watch the premiere. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be out there.
I was going to say I'll see you there because I'm going to go to that for sure. Yeah, yeah. Paul Hynek, of course.
I'll be with him in San Francisco. At the end of February, and I'll be with him in Contact in the Desert in May with Kevin Day and the rest of our expedition group. So maybe you can come out.
I love it, dude. And I don't want to speak out of turn and take up anyone's time, but I love what you're doing with what you're up to, man, with this new expedition thing, Kevin Day and everybody. And
thanks.
And it's Morgan Freeman's company's on board, if I believe, right? Is that right?
Yeah, it was not supposed to be announced yet, but I guess it's okay.
Yeah, that's right. I remember you telling me not to say anything, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Don't worry. I'll edit that out.
There's a cool documentary series upcoming that Dave Altman is involved with that is exploring, taking everything we now know about ATIP and, you know, and UFOs and where we are now, stuff from unidentified, and just continuing that investigation, continuing that study. That's all I'll say.
Martin, this is two exclusives on your radio.
Yeah, that's it.
You got that.
That's awesome.
You got the writers talking
the
about
it. Right,
I know.
And just for that, I'll expect a screener in my email.
That's right.
Now, Dave, do you have any particular question or you just wanted to say hi?
No, I'll let you go. I'll let some other people call in. I congratulate you for getting David actually on the phone because I never can. So I figured I would call.
Brother, I'm sorry, man. It's been crazy. We got to talk. I know.
All right. Congrats on the baby and the show, and I'll talk to you soon, guys.
Dave, talk to you real soon, man. You. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Later, bro.
All right. So that number is open if someone would like to call in. We have 5 more minutes. And that number's up on the screen. It is 855-472-5483. And we have a screener standing by, racist standing by to screen your call. So please call in if you have a question. Like I just said, we have about 5 minutes, so keep that in mind. And do you I don't know how much you can give out as far as the season upcoming now, but can you talk a little bit about some of the episodes that we can expect this year?
I think we can.
I'd love to. I think it only gets people more excited, and we're not giving anything away. You know, as we say, this season is about going back to the beginning to understand where the conspiracy began. And, of course, that starts with Roswell, which is a two-parter, how we open the season. We go into Area 51, which, again, is very much in the news these days.
Yep.
And I will just go on record as saying we had that in our we had that in our season pitch before people were planning on storming.
We did. It was one of those fortuitous things. Yeah. We're like, is this happening? Like, what? Yeah.
We have Maury Island, which is also considered one of the seminal cases in UFO lore in sort of the beginning of the Men in Black.
Yeah.
Which ties into the own mythology of our show. I don't want to give too much away, but... You know, at one point in history, based on all of his research, J. Allen Hynek was asked to be a part of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yep.
And I will say we will be giving a very strong nod
to that.
And yeah, that's with a wink, because we're doing more than that in an
yes,
upcoming episode.
Yep. Hopkinsville
is
a very famous
one,
case, sort of a home invasion alien alien case.
I love that case. Yeah,
I love that case too. I really love that case. That was one we, Sean and I had talked about it. We actually even were like, gosh, could we squeeze it into season one? And it was, you know, there just wasn't room for it with everything we were trying to do, but we got the opportunity to do it this year.
Skinwalker.
Yes, we go to Skinwalker Ranch.
Now, Skinwalker is Skinwalker. There was really nothing known about it during Project Blue Book, though.
So, yeah, in Skinwalker, the lore of it actually goes back to the 1800s.
Right.
The history there has been there for a while. So
yes,
all the stuff that was reported didn't necessarily catch the attention of Blue Book at the time. But again, this is, we love the idea and find a very organic way to get our guys in there.
That's true.
And there was it's a seminal piece of UFO history, and
we love it as just sort of like, you know, it's like a Bermuda Triangle on the ground. There's so much paranormal phenomena in and around that area, and we I think found a great way to do it where it's paying respect to the space. It's a cool episode and it's spooky. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of the questions I had, you know, after I watched the two Roswell episodes, and of course, I don't want to do any spoilers here of any
yes,
type, but did you happen to do any research? Were people actually talking about Roswell? Because it kind of, after, you know, it came out that they said that it was a weather of balloon, that cover up and all that, it kind of was quiet for many, many, many years. But I started thinking about it after watching your episode. Was it not quiet in Roswell itself? Were they actually talking about it? Do you know?
I mean, listen, you know, if the events that occurred in Roswell allegedly occurred, then people were talking about it from the very beginning. The fact that literally the front page headline is, you know, Roswell Army Air Force, or, you know, Roswell Army Air Force recovers crashed flying disc.
Yes, exactly.
That travels internationally. You know, people are, of course people are, I mean, I'd be shocked if guys like Donald Kehoe weren't at least poking their heads into those waters. In terms of it re-entering the national conversation, folks are right that began in about 1980 when, like, you know, those books started to come out about, you know, about what really happened at Roswell and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think, because I am also, and I think Sean is as well, a believer in the story that we all now know to be the Roswell story. I mean, there was always rumblings deep beneath the surface about what was happening in Roswell. So, I mean, that's a case of a town being silenced.
There's a great BBC documentary that goes back and revisits some of the witnesses and relatives of the Roswell case, who still had memories of it or were around to hear stories from relatives.
Yeah.
And people are still, like, when you watch it, it's like suffering from PTSD.
Yeah.
Sure.
So they stayed quiet because they were threatened and because the military basically said, I remember a line from one of these great books, Witness to Roswell.
Yeah.
It's like, your bones will bleach in the desert sun.
Yeah.
They'll never find you.
Right.
So, yes, does it make sense people weren't talking about it? 100%.
Right.
Because they were terrified. Does it make sense also that those people had stories to tell and were terrified to do so? Absolutely.
And then, of course, in those dark circles of power and where people knew what really occurred, yeah, I mean, those conversations continued, you know, but it was whispers. And our show lives sometimes in the content of whispers.
I liked it. I like what you did with it. We have Ron on. No, we're supposed to end the show right now. We're going to go just a little bit longer here. Ron from Minnesota. Ron, welcome to the show. You have a question for our guests.
Hi, Martin, and Happy New Year, and thank you guys for
Happy New Year.
Great show. Now I got to catch up. I had a question. What kind of research do you do, and what kind of resources do you use for the research, and how deep do you go with that research? Like, do you spend 5 minutes researching it and then say, oh, it's a story, or you say, oh, it's not a story, or do you know within 5 or 10 minutes you're going to make it a story?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
The good news is that, you know, David and I both come with a lot of previous knowledge. So we have a lot to be able to draw on with that. When we're looking at a case, a lot of times we've either read part of it in a book, watched part of it in a film, we do have some UFO experts that are, you know, big in the business that we rely on as well.
Yep.
And then we will use that as a jumping off point to then talk about our characters. Then we go back and get into the minutiae of the details and what we can use, because selfishly, we're also looking for those details to help us with story. So
that's right.
I would say 5 minutes is absolutely not. Five minutes is like, wouldn't even be a start for us. I'd say it's an hour conversation in the room where we talk about a case. And then because we're writers and we're all like predisposed to wanting to understand things, we'll all go about and read about something and come back into the room with notes and highlighted pages and books and articles and like, oh, did you see this? And then it all becomes this thing that we can sort of talk about together. And you know, so I would say, you know, total research anywhere from like, you know, 5 to 10 hours total during the course of writing an episode.
Sure.
Excellent.
And it's also one of those things where sometimes we go down the rabbit hole and we love the case. We love the case, but we can't find a way to make the case work with the stories that we're telling, you know, with our characters or this or that. So, you know, I mean, and those are endless hours too. And we're like, oh, we love this case. So, but once we commit to the case, like this is the case we're doing, we are as in, we try to find everything we can on it and then use what is going to work for us to tell the story that we need to tell while giving the case as much justice as we can possibly give it. But we also go down a zillion rabbit holes where we're like, oh, we think we're doing this case and then, you know, we're not doing it. And it, and that's okay too. I mean, you can't have them all. That's the thing. We get 10 episodes. You want to love them all like children. And it's like, but if they slip through the cracks, hopefully next season, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe season Thank you very four, much. Thank
you get
you
this
much.
Case that slips through or whatever. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Ron. Hey, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Martin.
All right.
Have a great night.
Yeah, bye. You too. All right, everyone. So that is it for our two guests now. We're going to be back with Ted Rowe in just a minute. Thank you so much, you two. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Our pleasure,
Martin. Thank you.
All right, everyone. So hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages. All right. Welcome back. My guest for this hour is Ted Rowe. Ted, welcome to the show.
Hi, Martin, and hello to your listeners.
So glad to have you back. I believe you were one of the first live shows that I did. You were one of the first live streaming shows I did on YouTube. That's right.
Yeah. It was like 2017, wasn't it? Something like that,
a couple of years
ago.
Yeah. But you are in Hawaii, and I'm very lucky to be there, if you ask me that question. But for the person that is not familiar with who you are, could you please give a nutshell of your background, if you would?
Sure. I'm the executive director of NARCAP, which is the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. I've been involved with it since it started in 1999, and our focus has been on unidentified aerial phenomena involving aviation safety cases. We defined the term unidentified aerial phenomena. At the time, nobody was using it. Now it seems to be viral. So even the Navy apparently picked up the term. So we're all kind of moving in that direction for a better term than UFO. I've been involved with a lot of things sort of behind the scenes in the UFO matter here, but we signed the first research agreement with another government. And we've done a number of things with NARCAP. So,
and it's basically a safe haven for, a commercial pilot to report a UFO and not be worried about, you know, backlash.
Pilots, air controllers, aviation professionals, to either take their reports or advocate on their behalf. Or provide advisory.
And would you say that Has anything changed in the last couple of years since you've been on the show? I mean, a lot has actually changed in the UFO field, but has it changed in as far as, you know, are more people feeling more confident about reporting or anything changed like that?
Well, it's interesting. In June, NARCAP published a pilot advisory, just kind of letting pilots and aviation professionals know what to expect in the event of a UAP incident, based on our years of research in the matter. And then it was very interesting. We saw traffic from about 90 countries and referrals to our website. Our work are showing up on international aviation websites and other places where the research is. So I think there's a strong underground around the subject. I can't say things have changed much, you know, in the body politic or anything around UFOs, but
what about
as far as our work?
Mm-hmm. Pardon me for
go ahead.
Walking over there. What about the FAA?
Oh, okay.
Have they changed their attitude at all? Because I will tell you that I've spoken to Tyler Rogaway, who writes a lot of blogs, and he has he's been having a pretty good open channel with the FAA when it comes to the UFO topic, like I've never heard prior.
Well, we're dealing with new generations coming into management, people that grew up with Star Trek. You know, people that grew up with UFO reports, people that maybe have seen UFOs themselves, and now they're officials or working in the aviation profession or working in the FAA. And I think underground there's quite an interest in the topic, but there is no place for a pilot to report UFOs to the FAA. They refer pilot reporters to private organizations rather than take the reports themselves, and that I think is the real key issue. You know, if you want to look for the benchmark, you know, the turning point, the turning point is when the FAA says that it'll start taking pilot reports and investigating them along with everything else.
But at least with
I was just going to say,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that I do know that, like, with the FAA has an aviation safety reporting system that it contracts out for pilots to make confidential reports about any kind of problem, you know, conflicts with air controllers, any kind of problem that they have that they don't want to be punished for, but the data should go somewhere.
Hmm.
It goes to the ASRS group. And they were very welcoming when my team briefed them. And were very supportive. They even came on the Channel 7 News and talked about it for 10 minutes or so, a few weeks after that. So there are channels where the subject is actually relevant to people working and at like the analysts in the aviation safety reporting system, and those folks aren't really bashful about being educated because they get these reports from time to time. But others in the administration of the FAA don't come anywhere near the subject and probably wouldn't want to risk their reputations on it. So those are the kind of problems we're looking at. I think they're institutional issues. It isn't so much of the subject itself. It's just people worried about their image.
Wow. Now, do you actually yourself have a communication channel with anyone at the FAA?
Well, yeah, we communicate with not regularly. Let me retract that. No, we don't have a channel with the FAA.
Mm-hmm.
I know where to go if I've got information or I want information, but generally speaking, no, we don't have a back channel into the FAA.
Yeah. I remember the last time that you were on the show. You told me about this incredible, encounter that you had yourself. That actually mm-hmm. was one of those ones that stuck with me. I talked to a lot of people, but I remember now. I hope I'm not mixing you up. I really do, but I think I remember you talking about you were in Oakland, and you felt like this intelligence knew that you were in a car. Am I getting that right?
Well, yeah, it was more like I knew it was there before I saw it.
It had that kind of quality to it. Yeah.
I knew it was there and then started looking for it, and it was right. There was a person between me and it, and I had to look around her. She was driving in order to see it. But yeah, that was pretty formative for me. It wasn't my first rodeo, but when pilots come to tell me things, it makes a pretty hard point in the spear. I'm very willing to listen to what people have to say because I've seen it myself.
Yeah.
Very close quarters.
Yeah. I have told this story, in the past, briefly on the show, but I was riding next to a American Airlines pilot that was deadheading, basically, and just got in a conversation, and I brought up the UFO topic, but I did it in a roundabout way. I said, "Hey, did you happen to see that New York Times article?" And he said, "Yeah, I've seen something about that, back in 2017 when that came out." And mm-hmm. he goes, "I know UFOs are real." And so I'm like, "Oh, yeah, tell me about it." He was actually a military pilot. He was in a Hornet or something. Might have been earlier, the predecessor to whatever that was. And I don't know what type of jet he was in, but he was actually followed for a long time by a green glowing object. But he wouldn't talk about it publicly. I asked him if I could talk to him about it on the show. He didn't want anything to do with it. And of course, he was a commercial airline pilot. And I'm just wondering, do you think that taboo will ever fade away for a commercial pilot to be able to talk about a UFO encounter freely, or do you think it's here to stay? What's your opinion on that?
Not without leadership. If people of good conscience and strong image stand up and speak clearly about what is known and what isn't known, then others will follow. There's no reason to think that responsible, intelligent, capable, experienced people don't see unusual things. And we should listen to them. Pilots have brought us new science around things that we didn't know existed before. And now they've been telling us for quite a few decades that they've been seeing something unusual, and they should be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then the stigma will lift. We get a lot of cases that come to us when pilots retire and they finally feel like they don't have anything to lose and they can come and talk to us. Which gives us historical cases, and sometimes data comes through in that's helpful. But I got a case this year from a military case from March of this year involving a high altitude reconnaissance pilot and a flight instructor at the same time who had an encounter with something. And at NARCAP, we've kind of decided not to publish pilot cases. We'll take the data, but we won't make them public just because it seems like there's some security issues around all of it. It's kind of like the Nimitz case. What do our adversaries learn about our sensing capabilities by watching our interaction and response to this thing and by these pilots publicly discussing this? There's a downside,
Mm-hmm.
And so I've decided with NARCAP just to only publish the commercial and public cases and I'll archive the military cases. And all so far, every military flyer I've dealt with since I sort of restarted NARCAP is willing to speak to politicians, congressmen, or whomever in private about it. So that's what I'm really trying to cultivate with NARCAP is enough access in the right places to be able to bring witnesses in and discuss it with the powers that are without making a public spectacle out of it. Just try to get something concrete and intelligent moving on this subject.
Now, I have mentioned this on the show before. I took a sabbatical from my regular job for about a year and a half, and I was a flight attendant with Pan Am 3. and did a lot of government charters. But I got to know a lot of the pilots, and I spent some time in the cockpit. I loved to be in there during the landings and takeoffs and things like that. But I noticed, you know, in the cockpit, you can see for miles and miles and miles. And it's almost surprising that, you know, when someone has 10,000 hours in their career that they never see anything. But I have spoken to a lot of them that I worked with that have not seen anything for all those thousands and thousands of hours. But usually it's followed by, but I have a friend that I know that actually saw something. You know, you hear something like that.
We did a survey. NARCAP did a survey of a regional air carrier, and we had about a 28% response rate, or 26.8% response rate, which was amazing because they had to fold it up, put it in an envelope, send it back to us, you know, after completing it. And out of that, it was about one in six that had personal experience. And of the 8 or 10 or so that had experiences, one of those seemed to be a direct safety-related encounter. I don't know how you extrapolate that data. That's one sample. But it's been that way sort of informally, just talking the subject around with people, too. It's about one in six people that says, yeah, I saw one, you know.
Well, as many people,
it's not surprising.
And many people have said before me that it only takes one real one. You know.
There's no question. You know, when one of these things is in your face, it's not. You know, I've never been perplexed by what I was looking at. It was too close for it to be anything other than what it was. It wasn't some light at a distance that could have been an airplane or could have been anything else. It was less than its own length from my windshield, it just is what it is, whatever it is, and I've got maybe a dozen of those through my life, and I'm willing to bet there are a lot of people out there who've never really talked about it or even thought about it that have probably had more than one exposure to this phenomena, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of underground information. I watched my pilot advisory, just a pilot advisory on my website, get hit over and over and over and over again from everywhere. Iran, Kenya, South Africa, China, a lot of China. Just like I said, about 90 countries, Moldova, okay, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and they only hit that page and read it. And so which means that they're probably pilots, probably commercial pilots, and people are passing around the URL. But it tells you there's an underground, you know, and these guys, they know what's going on, and they're passing it around amongst their own. And I get pilots contacting me that aren't witnesses from time to time that want to kind of get a feel for, you know, what it is they're that is going around them that they may not have direct experience with as well. So there's a lot of interest in this, at least in the pie slice that NARCAP is dealing with, which is aviation safety cases, not ground observations, not abductions, not anything else, just pilot cases.
Are you able to talk about some of the cases? I mean, are they public where people can access?
Although I haven't published any of our recent investigations because I'm trying to develop a review process that's internal that keeps us from overstepping or wording things inappropriately, you know, to make sure that we're presenting things accurately, you know, and that we're not saying something's a UAP if it isn't, you know, peer review. But I've got some cases that we're working on there, but I can talk about, one of the cases we're working involves a commercial air crew who took camera phone photographs and video of a UAP that manifested out in front of their aircraft and then crossed from their right to their left and then accelerated away from them. And they sent me about 45 seconds of video and some photographs and a number of descriptions of what they had seen and encountered. It had happened on a day when SpaceX was putting a booster up was launching one of its heavies, and but I did a bunch of research around it all, and between that and what the pilots described, it wasn't an orbital object. It was right in front of the airplane, and in fact, it slowed down a little bit, came closer to the aircraft, and then passed in front of it, and then accelerated away from it and off to the left.
Wow. And so when you're watching this video, I mean, it sounds like amazing video.
Well, it's pretty good. It's basically a bright light. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see a structured object in the representation of the video, and none of the air crew described one. They described it as an indistinct ball of light. Interestingly enough, I've got photographs taken by a commercial captain in 2006 that looked just like it. So, we just work through the data, make sure that we were certain that it's not mundane, that we've asked all the questions that should be asked about whether it's mundane or not, and then decide on how to score the case. How do you catalog it? You know, you've got the video and the photographs. In the video, you can hear the air crew talking about it. So there's some interactive quality with the video and interaction between the air crew and the object. The object's dead in front of the airplane, which I consider that a safety factor myself.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get radar data. They asked for radar confirmation and there wasn't any, which is common. And I consider it kind of defining. It's a intermittent radar detectability is a common issue in UAP reports.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get radar confirmation, sometimes you don't. It doesn't mean there wasn't anything there. That's the kind of cases I'm working. This one, once I get the final write-up done, I'm going to share with our NARCAP branches in Germany and probably Canada. And then share with a couple of other private individuals I know. And once we know that everything's sound, then we'll go ahead and publish it.
You know, the one thing that is sort of puzzling, and maybe you can clear this up a little bit, is to me it seems like when there is an aviation safety issue, why isn't the FAA or the TSA or whoever else is involved in aviation, why aren't they taking it more seriously as, you know, something that could be threatening? It comes to mind like the C-17, you know, in Chicago.
Yeah.
The O'Hare incident.
Mm-hmm.
A total, like, hazard that was just kind of, you know, pushed away as if it was nothing.
Right.
So why is that when it's something actually does affect the safety of not just, you know, the plane itself, but, you know, the entire, you know, crew aboard and all the passengers. Why isn't it taken more seriously?
Well, there's two sides of it, okay? First off, you have an institutional sickness, okay, where the investigating bodies and the bodies that conduct oversight have a blind side to that particular problem. Of all the obscure types of problems that couldn't be a risk, that's just not one that they've been forced to look at. Okay, so you've got that side of it. And then the other side of it is that, okay, you do your investigation, and the investigation reveals that a ramp controller and ground crews that were shuttling aircraft saw something hovering over C-17 and over gate C-17, and it exited, leaving a hole in the clouds. It wasn't seen by the air traffic controllers in the control tower, right? So when you're done writing this thing up, what do you have? And is it enough to change policy, to write policy? And what policy would you write other than maybe accommodate reporting?
I see. So there's... If a policy is not involved in changing something for the safety, then
right,
there's really nowhere to go. Is that basically what you're saying?
Basically, they're stuck with these outlier cases and outlier data, and it isn't enough for anybody to step forward and risk their career on yet. Mm. Okay, there's so many other You know, they weeded out quite a lot of, you know, every time there's a crack in one bolt, they pull all the bolts back. You know what I mean? Every time there's a problem with anything, the redundancies are in place to make sure the aircraft don't fall out of the sky. Generally speaking, of course, the 737 MAX story is a little different, but that was a software issue. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, you know, anytime they find anything wrong, they fix it. And so what you're looking at now is low frequency of occurrence events. The wings aren't folding off the airplanes like they did the Lockheed Electras and stuff. You know, everything's better than that now. The pilots are better, right? They're all matriculated military pilots with hard science degrees, you know, that kind of thing. Everything is better. So we, like in U.S. commercial aviation, we haven't lost an airliner in a very, very long time. It's been since 2009, I think, since we lost a commercial airliner. We've lost some transport planes and certainly small aircraft, but no commercial airliner crashes since 2009. And so discussing this, you know, this is a good time to talk about the low frequency of occurrence events and whether or not these unidentified aerial phenomena are a threat to safe aviation as we contend. And so I'm advocating. I'm doing my outreach.
Well, you know, I never really thought of it in that angle. But again, it goes back to the same reason why a lot of science won't take a look at UFOs, is it's something that, you know, happens infrequently, and it's not something that can be replicated. You know, it's a hit or miss type of situation. And so I can understand that. I never really thought of it in that way. I mean, when it comes to policies, what policy could be written as far as the FAA goes, other than, like you said, report the reporting end of it? That's about the only thing they could do.
Collect the data and take it seriously. And that's the first step. You know, science is often the last to really weigh in on things. It's behind the observation. It's not in front of it. You know, it hears, like, for example, I mentioned that pilots have contributed to science. Well, for decades, they were telling science that they were seeing lightning going from the tops of thunderheads into space.
Yeah.
And nobody believed them. The lightning doesn't work that way. Atmospheric physicists poo-pooed it. Nobody believed it. But a couple of atmospheric physicists in the 80s started documenting pilot reports of this. And they managed to get a picture from the ground, and then they managed to get cameras on the shuttle to document what are now sprites, gnomes, elves, dwarves, the whole panoply of high-altitude electricity, you know. And all of that came from pilots. Pilots had been talking about it for a very long time, and nobody took them seriously. We would have discovered those things long ago had we listened to what pilots were saying to begin with. So Pilots have been telling us something else, too, and failure to listen to them is at our own peril. And, again, science won't be the first up the line. It'll be people like us, people like NARCAP, and Dr. Haynes and myself and others that carry the ball forward and force a look at it. And once the data starts moving, then science has got to comment on it.
Now, I remember hearing about a case where a pilot – actually, you know, saw a UFO going alongside the plane, and the passengers saw it. Are there cases reported like that?
We get them from time to time, not as often as they show up on YouTube, of course. I mean, that most of that is nonsense. But,
right.
But yeah, from time to time we get them, and certainly some of the best-known cases over the years were cases that involved entire airliners, you know, with passengers. I'm thinking of some of the cases from the 50s and 60s where passengers were, you know, looking out the windows watching UAP right next to their aircraft and so on. And they do happen from time to time. We haven't had one quite like that that I know of in our 20 years, but I do acquiesce that they happen.
Right. You know, I've talked to, it seems like I've talked to, I had someone from Australia. I talked to them about the fires. I talked to the gentleman on just before you, on Project Blue Book executive directors about the the producers, executive producers, about fires near them. But you and I were in touch a year and a half ago or so when you had the lava flow out there. That was really scary, wasn't it?
Well, it was. I had actually bought my land a few months after I talked to you, and I bought it during the eruptions that were going on, and of course that put the property value down in reach.
You bought it during the eruptions?
And then, yeah. Because I kind of understood the geology of it all. I knew that where the lava was coming out down in Leilani Estates and where it was going under up at Kilauea. And I picked a spot almost dead center between the two. And over the ridge from my house, just a mile and a half, is the third vent, Pu'u'o'o. And the glow of the lava at night on three sides of my property was pretty interesting. Yeah. Every now and then we get ash fall, and occasionally we get sulfuric acid in the air and stuff, but not enough to even hurt the plants. So, and now it's all done, and I've got a couple of nice agricultural zoned acres here that are pretty good. Feeling pretty good about it.
Yeah. How far are you? I mean, you're actually on your phone, and we couldn't do this over Skype. How far are you from the nearest, I don't know what you call them, village town?
Well, Hilo town itself is about 20 miles away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out in the brush north of Kilauea, between Kilauea and the district of Puna. But I'm far off the beaten track. There's no electricity out here. There's nothing out here. I have to cut the jungle back so I can drive down the roads.
Oh my God! So how do you keep up with NARCAP and all that? All the information and everything. You go into town and go into to hook up to Wi-Fi at Starbucks or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can do a lot of just checking on things with my phone. I can take reports and people call, and I can handle the calls and that kind of stuff. And then I can go check in. But I've also got staff. There are other members of NARCAP. Since I spoke to you last, I told you that it was my intention to restructure NARCAP, and I've done that and purged a lot of dead weight and put in. There's a strong management group that at present isn't ready to be up in front. And I'm kind of doing the advisory work, and I set up the new website, helping with kind of getting everything on the ground for them. And I may or may not stay with this program. I've got a couple of things in the works right now. So,
what would you say is the best benefit of NARCAP? Is it just what I mentioned earlier, that it's a safe place for pilots to report, or what is the best contributing factor of it?
Well, I think we contribute not only to aviation and advocacy for pilots and aviation professionals, but it's also UAP studies in general. The last paper we put out was on the flight dynamics of four profiles of unidentified aerial phenomena that are commonly reported by pilots during safety encounters. And so it was an examination of flight dynamics of UAP, which is fairly new. I think one of the guys from MUFON, or the former science director of MUFON, got a paper out on something related to flight dynamics last summer. So, but my point is that there's actual studies of phenomena themselves and reports that are very focused on the phenomena themselves, so that we can learn more about what they are, how they move, why they're unique. That study, go ahead.
No, can you share some of the flight dynamics?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, first off, we looked at balls of light, spheres, disks, and cylinders. And we cataloged all the ways that they've been reported moving that we had in our thing. You know, like sometimes you'll hear about disks moving belly bottom first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or top first, or rim first, you know, rotating, sometimes not rotating, this kind of thing. Document all of that. Making angular turns, okay, without decelerating. So they're just moving along and bang, they go 90 degrees, okay? All of these things, we documented, and it turns out all four of these profiles have the same types of movements. There's seven types of movements they do that are the same. And these are the angular turns, the sudden stops, the sudden start accelerations, the hovering, this kind of thing. And they have common characteristics in appearance. They do not have thrust ports. Okay, so that you don't hear a jet sound. There's no blast into the ground. You don't see big contrails of billowing smoke, you know, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So if one of these things is moving along at 100 miles an hour and comes to a dead and sudden stop, an instantaneous stop, well, inertia is the resistance of an object in motion to stop moving or to change direction. And so what you're seeing is something that isn't inertial. The thing is stopping itself. An airplane balances four forces of thrust, lift, drag, and gravity, and then deals with environmental factors like air resistance, right? And so it decelerates and slows itself down while it's balancing all these things, and it stays in the air. Our UAP don't do that. They don't have wings. They don't have aerodynamic surfaces to begin with. They don't seem to be affected by drag. They don't seem to be affected by air resistance. I've seen them moving exceptionally quick at sea level, where the atmosphere is most dense, where you'd expect fire and an explosion, you know?
Right. No sonic booms either.
Right, and no sonic booms. So basically what you come down to is that all four of these phenomena have similar characteristics that may be lie the same principal cause or source.
Very interesting.
Okay, so that's an extrapolation, but it's a reasonable one. All right, and then other things like if they're not balancing these forces and they're able to stay in the air, then I mean, we have an expectation that when we see an object moving through the air, that it's subject to the environment it's in. Mm-hmm. That whatever environmental factors of forces of gravity and drag and everything else are there working on it. And if they aren't, then it's decoupled from the local environment. And now we're heading into theoretical physics. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's as far as we took the paper, but you know, these are the kind of studies that NARCAP wants to contribute to, you know, based on the data we've got, you know, digest it and move it forward, move the study forward.
Now,
and we're not the only ones doing this. Erling Strand out in Hesteland, Norway, got a really good study working. Massimo's been, Piotrani's been contributing all along in the field. There are good minds at work here, and they're all trying to do this. So eventually I would expect to see a topic under UAP studies come together where we're one of a number of contributors.
I see. Now, is it lights in the sky? Is that the most common of what it gets reported to NARCAP?
Well, yeah, I would say that. Yeah, light phenomena. It's either objects with lights on them or just lights.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Just a topic that's come up a lot of times when a listener called in, I don't know, maybe a couple months ago, 3 months ago, and said, you know, why would they have lights to begin with?
Yeah.
You know, if they were coming from another planet or wherever they're coming from, why would they have lights? And I thought that was a very good question. But, you know, I mean, you see that a lot. I mean, you hear it a lot.
Well, I think the first thing to do is take the data. Find the data, look at the data itself, and then work on trying to understand the whys behind it. But make sure that you know what the data says to begin with. In my experience, my personal experience, this thing had red and green running lights on it. And I could see the crew, and they were obviously not human. And I could see the entire interior of the device. I grew up in an aviation household. The thing was less than its own length from the windshield of my car. And yet it had green and red running lights. Go figure.
Amazing.
So the idea there, Rob, is my understanding, the way to look at it is that whoever these infiltrators are have been here a while and are doing their best to at least slightly mimic aircraft, you know, when they're doing missions that are in urban environments, you know. Of course, that's all on my personal side. NARCAP hasn't resolved anything as far as whether these things are alien or not. But in my own experience, I saw UAP with running lights on it.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you actually saw beings. I don't remember that part of it. I should remember that part.
See, what happened between then and now, between when I first told you this story in 2017 and now, is I've gone ahead and written the thing up, and I had a computer graphic artist actually make a representation of what it was that my friends and I saw, and decided to just add that to our UAP studies as raw data. So that's coming out shortly. But basically, this thing, we saw it from miles away. It was a yellow light on top of a white light, and it turned and became a yellow rectangle with two white lights under it. And on the right end of it, it had a red light and a green light on top and a red on the bottom. No, other way around, red on top, green on bottom, that were flashing irregularly. And then we watched the thing come. We were on the Bay Bridge interchange, and we watched the thing come. This is in Oakland. Right. And we watched it come down Highway 24 below the level of the sky rises. And it stopped right next to the Oakland Federal Building. And we were down at that point. We were down towards 7th Street and Army Depot area and the post office. And as we were looking at it, the thing leaped and it came to a sudden stop in front of our car, Leslie owned its own length from the windshield. And it moved so fast, if I had blinked, I wouldn't have seen it move.
Wow.
Sue was driving, and my friend Ian was in the back seat, and I was in the passenger seat, and we were all looking at it, and Sue's looking at these three not people standing there looking at us, and the stop should have killed them. You know, the movement should have killed them, all right? Mm-hmm. This thing moved so fast that, like I said, if I hadn't had my eyes open and looking at it when it moved, I wouldn't have seen the motion, and it should have killed them. They didn't rock on their heels. Susan says, Ted, are those? And meaning, Ted, are those aliens? And I, because I ruined a lot of Thanksgiving dinners for around this subject. And I kind of blurted out no and slid down in my seat. And then things just got weird. And what took 9 minutes for us to drive took 3 hours to elapse. I can't explain that other than maybe when you get really close to these things, there's an event horizon of some kind with temporal disturbance of some kind, and you lose time. But that was the one. And then I sent a message to Ames Research Center a few months later. I was very sick. The whole thing was just very disturbing, and I was very sick. And I wrote this terse little note to Ames Research Center. I know you guys don't study these things, but you probably should. And I saw one on X date at X time and X location. And if anybody wants to talk to me about it, I'm available. And Dr. Haynes got back to me in a matter of hours. And that's where it all started for me as far as doing UFO work.
Oh, wow.
And then I just had to keep it down. I didn't talk about it until after Dr. Haynes left the organization. I shared it with friends and stuff, but I never put it out like in a podcast or something like I'm doing now. I never talked about it. It's not something to make money off of. It's not something to get attention for. It's the subject itself is serious enough without my name attached to it. There's plenty of people that have these things happen to them, and I know it. So
yeah,
here I am.
Well, now, Dr. Haynes, I did get to meet him, a really nice gentleman. I met him, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago down in North Carolina. And when did he retire?
2015. December 2015, I think it was.
Like I said, real nice gentleman. And basically, you kind of filled his position. Is that right at the time, or what went on?
Yeah. Well, basically, Dick had been telling me for some time that he was going to step down. He's heading into his 80s, and he was ready to do it. He's a family man. He's a church-going man, so on. And he felt that he wanted to wrap it up in good form and do it fairly well. And so he stepped down in December. And I just let things kind of go for a while. I kept the website up, but I just let everything sit for a couple of years. I needed to think about it and try to understand, because I'm not in this for fun. You know, I'm in this because I've been exposed to it, and for me, it's not a joke, and I'm easily triggered. It causes a lot of anxiety. I stress over the work I do with NARCAP. And so I needed to rethink it and really understand what I was doing and what NARCAP could do and whether or not we were doing it right and if we should change it. And so I stewed on that for quite a while. And then I January a year ago, I started moving on it and then put up the new website in June and started pursuing the new business model with it right after. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I'm sorry that
just go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to, when I hear people say that they, you know, it stresses them. You know, it's you know, I hate to hear that, but I totally understand it. But I'm going to ask you this too: has that also this encounter, the encounters that you have, has that actually benefited other people that you take reports from, or, you know, have you been able to make it work in your favor as far as that goes?
I'm always got a compassionate ear. Mm-hmm. I'm the last person to tell people that they didn't see something unusual.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm a critical listener. And if the data isn't there, the data isn't there. You know what I mean? It's a story until there's something I can use, something I can recognize, you know? So I'm always willing to listen. I know people have these encounters. We're dealing with people that have different intelligence levels, different types of cognitive dissonance that kicks in when they deal with it, different types of emotional reactions and so on. So the stories can vary, and you've just got to listen really carefully and watch carefully and notice, you know, so you can see who's probably not an authentic experiencer and who very likely is, you know. And then just be careful with it. I gray file a lot of data that I can't validate. I just put it in a gray file. I don't condemn it, but we're understanding more every day about our physical world and pushing our boundaries of understanding out further. So it's appropriate to be careful and not just dismiss things outright. Like I said, like an object that's decoupled from the local environment. What is that? I mean, you know, but how do you explain it any other way? And if that's the case, then how is that possible? And is that natural or is that technology?
Hmm. Interesting.
So on.
Now, can you kind of walk us through what happens when, say, a pilot may call your number, and how does the whole thing happen, and how what type of information do you require, and what does the investigations look like, if any?
Well, the first thing we do is we make them aware that everything we do is confidential, but that we do need to be able to validate who they are as pilots. So they need to share their operating number and so on so that we can validate that they're aviation professionals or pilots or whatever. And then and usually that's not a problem, you know. And then we ask them for any evidence they have, if they could send us a photocopy, if they wrote it down in their flight log, you know, if they documented what they saw in their journal, that kind of thing. And of course we want to know how long ago the incident was. Did it happen in the last 2 weeks, or is it more of a historical case? And the reason for that is that we can get a FOIA request out if it happened a few days ago or less. You know, there's time to get a FOIA request out and maybe get data. We get encrypted radar data that we can reconstruct the. We have algorithms that can reconstruct the radar plots, so we can look at that. And then we want the audio from the, if they talk to the air controllers about it. And then we have a lot of questions, you know, who, what, where, when, what, you know. Mm-hmm. And get a full description, and then really work it over, make sure that. They weren't seeing air traffic from, aviation test area, military test site, whether, you know, there were rocket launches, missile launches, whether there was falling space debris, you know, all of that. Go through all the mundane possibilities and make sure that every question that should be asked gets asked. And if at the end of that, when you get all the way out to the other end and you've got enough data to make a decision and you still can't describe what it is, then that's a UAP. That's an unidentified aerial phenomenon.
Right.
And then you let the stuff pile up and you collect statistics over groups of them and start looking at the larger picture, you know.
Now, a few years ago, I think it's been since you've been on the show, but I'm not 100% sure. There was, I want to say, in the western states somewhere, possibly maybe even Arizona or maybe even west, further north, like Oregon or something, there were a couple of commercial flights. I think there were two different incidents where there are multiple pilots from different airlines, commercial airlines, seeing something. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that case. I've listened to the recorded conversations of the air crews in one of those cases. And it's interesting. I don't know if it, they kept referring to it as an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like a code word for it's not an airplane, the way they said it. But, but you have to take them at their word. They said it was an airplane. And it was at a distance. It was very quick, whatever it was. And I don't know whether that's a test craft or not. I didn't find enough data in the dialogue and the conversations to tell me that that was an unidentified versus, a high-tech, hypersonic aircraft, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I don't know. They were at operating, altitudes around, I think it was 28,000 feet, so that's not terribly high. And often these high-performance aircraft want to be up where there's low atmospheric friction, you know, where they,
right,
they can really haul up range. But there again, I'm not the engineer putting the things out. So in that case, I come down firmly on, I don't know what the heck that was. And I'm not certain that it wasn't, military.
Mm-hmm. I can't believe this already. We only have a couple minutes left. And I told you, this week when we were texting back and forth that I wanted to talk quickly about the drones over in Colorado. What do you think about that? That's pretty interesting.
I think it's interesting. I think the most interesting thing about it is, although they're calling it drones, none of the witnesses are calling it drones.
Yes.
And none of the investigating agencies are calling it anything but drones, but they have no evidence that they're drones.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And when you look at the video, it doesn't look like a drone.
Right.
And if you've ever been around a drone where you're close enough to video a drone, you can hear them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they aren't. So if you've got drones encroaching onto your property and following your car down the road, what the heck? You know, especially, you know, what I saw didn't look like a drone. Okay, so I come down on a, maybe it's a UAP. We need more data in that case. That's certainly a busy area. Northern Colorado, Nebraska area there. There's a lot of history around UFO
Absolutely.
Stuff there.
Yeah, I talked to Chris Chris O'Brien, and he said, yeah, it's pretty weird. he's going to be looking into it more. All right. Well, Ted, we're out of time. Thank you so much. It went by fast, and it's always a great pleasure to talk to you. And good luck with your land out there.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, and regards to your listeners, and we'll talk soon, Martin.
All right. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, everyone. So that's it for the show. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to be back next week with Sweden's Klaus Svahn. He has a new book out. I always enjoy having him on the show. He's a repeat guest. Check that out next week. And again, I want to thank everyone that helps out. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.